Well, let's see. Well, welcome to the Watkins Visiting Professor program in this particular lecture series is in physics. And today's talk is by Professor Kathy Levin. And Kathy's actually a native of central Kansas. And she was born here, but not raised here. She said she left when she was 6 months old. So we still welcome her back as a native of central Kansas. She had her undergraduate degree in physics from Berkeley. She then went off to get her PhD in physics from Harvard. She did a series of postdocs, UCLA, Rochester, come to mind. But since 1975, she's been on the faculty of the University of Chicago and part of the James Franck Institute there. Her specialty is superconductivity and cold condensed Fermi gases. And her she was the head of the Superconducting Center of the Chicago side for the NSF, which is a large project. And she also has been doing recently, and you'll hear more about this in tomorrow's scientific talk, where she's going to be talking about cold Fermi gases. But her talk today for the public is based on trying to relay to the public ideas of superconductivity, the players, the applications, and the future. So let's welcome Kathy.
Is it hard to see, or is there a different light option? Do you feel like it's hard to see? No?
Just the light. You're writing in this room. I teach in this room. It's not a very good room.
I don't want to put everybody to sleep, which is easy with dark.
I don't know if that one does.
Darkness.
I'm trying to figure out. I never did figure out
that lighting arrangement.
Is that any better?
Yeah.
It's hard to read, though, isn't it? Maybe it's just this one. Let's see if it gets better. Since there's so few people, I'm happy to have discussions and interruptions. I'm meant to try to convey. Oh, okay. Green is probably a better one. Meant to try to teach something about superconductivity and. I think, to some extent, the Tuesday Times and the Brian Greene and Stephen Hawking books are really great at telling the story of cosmology and particle physics, and you know rather less, should turn this on, about tabletop science. At least that's not as emphasized as... Too loud? Not as emphasized in the popular literature, but in fact, tabletop science, whether it's MRIs or trains that you may someday ride on, or new devices in your hardware store, really play a more important role in your everyday life. So in some sense, the kind of physics I'm talking about is has an advantage over all the mysticism of strings and whatnot. I'm not really apologizing for not doing strings, but it has an advantage that this is going to impact and does impact your life in big, big ways. So I wanted to try to relay that and relay it in the form of a bit of anecdotal stories about its discovery, superconductivity discovery, lots of interesting interpersonal relations that sort of reveal how scientists think, physicists think, and then tell you a bit about applications, because I'm sure you know something about MRI, but maybe that it's dependent so strongly on superconductivity you may not know. And then where is it going? What problems of society can eventually solve? Is that better? That's a lighter one. I think it was just this light. So in a sense, I wanted this to be the human side of tabletop physics, since we don't so much gaze into the heavens, but we do have interesting people and interesting stories. A lot of the stories and a lot of the discoveries of superconductivity really revolve around graduate student participation. So I'm going to try to make that very clear to you, that it's often the graduate students who are the lead, who got the great idea or made the great observation. In our major Nobel Prizes that I will try to summarize for you. And not only do we have lots of Nobels, but I don't know how many of you know about the Ig Nobel Prizes. This is, I'll come back to it, but this is a photograph from a recently awarded Ig Nobel Prize in which a sumo wrestler is being levitated slightly off the table. I'll show you a little more detail. But that garnered the Ig Nobel Prize for interestingly provocative physics of some nature or another. But I think one thing that's impressive about superconductivity, if you lump it with superfluidity, because these do really go together, we can talk about that, is the number, large number of Nobel Prizes. So we, in some sense, are kind of unique because, one, we know when we're right. The tabletop experimentalists, the tabletop theorists can talk to each other, and we know rightness is established. It's not a marginal issue. We're right. So that obviously makes us a little bit better candidates for prizes. And in addition, we have lots of devices that come out of these designs. So I think in the spirit of the Nobel Award is the are those two components, which probably explains why over at any other subfield, and I think it depends on how you count Nobels, but I'll show you some of the typical examples of our Nobel collection. There are at least 9 and probably more, and they're keeping, numbers are growing, so we're not anywhere near done. Here, so I'm going to start with some Nobel laureates. This was a reasonably recent Nobel Award in 2003, and I'll come back to these various players. This is Tony Leggett, who worked on superfluid helium, proved that it was superfluid in the theory sense. This is Alex Abrikosov. Both of these are in Illinois, Midwesterners, and this is Vitaly Ginzburg. They got the prize in 2003. And here too, these are characters, so I want you to see their pictures as we talk about some of their character behavior. This is Lev Landau, very famous physicist who didn't do superconductivity for his Nobel, but who's played an important role in understanding superconductivity. And this is Phil Anderson, who may be familiar even to some of the particle physicists. We'll come back to him as well. And I wanted here to put up a picture. This is actually on the poster from Debbie Ginn, because the talk is that this young, very young woman in the next few years, certainly in the buzz, is that she may well get a Nobel Prize for her discovery, along with a few others, possibly. She would share it, but she's the front runner for a Nobel discovery of superfluidity in atomic Fermi gases. So, an interesting collection of people. Just one of the stories to start with, Alex Abrikosov is very forthright, very honest. He's not got a lot of friends, and I think it took him a long time to get a Nobel because he had no friends. But he does tell the story of how Lev Landau, who was the head of the institute where Alex worked as a student, basically tried to prevent him from publishing his Nobel work. He had discovered, and we'll talk a little bit about what that means, but he had discovered the concept of vortices in superconductors, the idea that there'd be little regions that could let magnetic field in or could swirl around if it was a superfluid. And Landau said, no, that's absolutely wrong, put it in the desk, which he did for a number of years in good obedience. And then eventually he published and it was proved right very shortly thereafter. So again, a graduate student kind of rising to having the courage of his convictions, which is really an important component. Here's another graduate student story. The actual discovery in 1911 of superconductivity was due to Cameron, or is credited to Cameron Onnes. It's a picture here, and he was on the stamp. And this is actually data from his notebook, or his student's lab notebook. And the vertical axis is missing here, but it's the resistance as a function of temperature of liquid mercury. It's a kind of unusual metal because it's liquid even at very cold temperatures. And the observation that lab made was that the resistance went away at some temperature, just plummeted to zero. What that meant at the time was that they had discovered something which you can call a superfluid, a superconductor. It was flowing without resistance. That's something I'll come back and try to say in a little more quantitative detail. The story has it that actually the students did these experiments while he was on vacation, and they didn't have email, and they didn't have telephones or whatever, so they wrote telegrams to him and said, we found this great observation, something wild and crazy is This is Dutch, I'm paraphrasing. Something very strange is going on in liquid mercury. And we think you better come back from your vacation. And he was enjoying himself, and he said, I think you should reproduce the experiment, double check it. Which they did, and they wrote back and said, you better come back, it's there, it's real, it's repeatable. And at which point he decided he should come back, and he did the experiment himself and sent the students on vacation and wrote the paper. So I don't know if that's entirely anecdotal, but it's that there is a bit of that in all fields, I suppose. So I think this is a picture, I think it's Einstein in the corner there, but it's amazing that the discovery was such a challenge for so many people. And so just to note some of the more recognizable people who tried to explain why the resistance went away. You may recognize Richard Feynman here, and of course Einstein. These people supposedly, I don't know that the papers ever got published, but they tried very hard to come up with some explanation for why the resistance went away. And it's the story here is that Feynman actually received the paper that then was a solution, the Barleen Cooper Schrieffer paper. He got it preprint mail in those days, and he could see immediately it was right, and it made him so sick. He stuck it in a drawer, could not bear to read it for about a year, and then he knew it was right. It didn't take long to realize how simple it was and how beautiful and inclusive. So he didn't get it, but he had his own Nobel anyway. So this guy, you may know. And then not so well-known physicists, this is Butler Chafroth, or our communities, people who got really close but didn't get the gold ring. So the gold ring went to Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer. Bardeen is here. He's the senior guy on the trio who discovered a theory to explain superconductivity. Cooper was a postdoc, and Schrieffer was the graduate student. And an interesting story about Bardeen was that at the time they were working through this theory, he had just received word that he had gotten a Nobel Prize. Not for this, because it hadn't been published, but for the transistor. So here's a guy who has made two major Nobel, big Nobels and little Nobels. These are two big Nobels, because you could say the transistor is probably the most important consequence of science, medicine, and physical science in this century. I mean, it's changed the way we live our lives. So this is a guy who did it twice and has no color at all. I mean, unlike a Feynman who had this bongo playing style, he's just a very serious, kind of slow talking guy, but had done beautiful work twice. And the graduate student here was said to have put in a very important component. This was his PhD, and he invented BCS theory. He understood what they recognized, that what was going on in the superconductor was that electrons were pairing up. They were trying to find partners, and sometimes it's mentioned as a sort of, or shown in a cartoon of a choreographic dance or something, that the pairing was going on. They understood, and it even went by the name Cooper pairing, which belonged to the middle gentleman here. But Schrieffer wrote down this brilliant out of his head wave function that was really the opening step to finding the theoretical machinery for explaining superconductivity. And he did it as a graduate student, and really can't beat work that's done at that level as a graduate student, but he went on to have and still has a career in physics. Here's another graduate student who really knocked everybody's socks off, if you could say that. It's Brian Josephson, who in 64, he had read the BCS paper, had studied it, and thought there was a very unusual effect being predicted by that paper, which they hadn't noticed. And that was an interesting interference, because superconductors with this Schrieffer wave function are big, huge quantum states, all connected. And there was some unusual quantum interference going on in the superconducting phase, and this is now known as the Josephson. He didn't really have a thesis advisor. I think he was working hard, but he was able to talk to this gentleman, Phil Anderson, who was visiting in Cambridge at the time, And Phil read the paper, and he said, you know, you're right. I'm not going to put my name on it, but you should publish it. It's definitely right. It gave him a lot of encouragement. So this was a single-authored, I believe, single-authored paper by Brian Josephson. Now, Brian Josephson got a little flaky in later life. It didn't take long, because when you do something this monumental as a PhD student, there's nothing left to top. So, but Cambridge University, being impressed with his original Nobel PhD, has kept him on, and he runs what's called a mind-matter unification project at, is there a question? At Cambridge. And they, you know, they tolerate and brings in speakers and talks about extrasensory perception and such things. But it's remarkable to do something that great. I don't want to take away from that. There he is in his more modern state. Okay, another graduate student. Just I'll run through a few more of these. I feel like so many Nobels were pioneered by the young people, the crowd. This is a Nobel that went to Doug Osheroff, Robert Richardson, and David Lee in 1973. And this was a direct spin-off, again, of the BCS paper, that as soon as people saw how BCS theory worked, they realized this dancing partner idea would apply to other fermionic systems, like helium-3, and it should be a superfluid. And that was a very interesting prediction, and that really drove the field of low-temperature physics. And the idea that there was the superfluid to be found was a holy grail, and lots of experimental techniques were developed to get to colder and colder temperatures. And that was a huge advance in physics, not just for superconductivity, but just to get cryogenically cold. Every time that the experimentalists got to where the theorists said it would be, of course, theorists said, well, we better revise, because they didn't find it. And they pretty much gave up. And by 1973, Osheroff's PhD thesis was going to be on the study of solid helium-3 in some magnetic order, because they weren't even thinking the superfluid was a possibility. Theorists were so slippery, they just kept changing the temperature. But he had to be doing his experiments at a particular design, so he was studying the solid phase, but he had liquid in it, like a liquid-solid ice mixture. So he had liquid incidentally in the doer. And he saw some very strange glitches, and he didn't want to give up on those glitches. It turned out other groups had those glitches. I even saw them in some of the data books in West Coast labs. But this guy was not going to give up, and he went to, I'm not sure his advisors would have been conscientious, but he went to Tony Leggett, this guy, this gentleman here, and said, I want you to look at what I've got. There's something going on. And Tony recognized that it was from the liquid. It wasn't the solid he wanted to study. It was from the liquid that was incidentally in the doer. And Tony also recognized that it was a superfluid that he had discovered. And then he went on to do a lot of work that led to a Nobel for Leggett. So graduate students really rule here. Let's see. Here's a discovery. Here's where graduate students didn't save the day. But this was a quite serendipitous discovery that we all got excited about. I know Jim Ho got pretty involved in the stories of the high TC superconductors. They came along in 1986. By 86, we kept hoping we could get higher temperatures. I'll show you that most technology would be greatly enhanced if you didn't have to pay all this money to cool. So we wanted high TC, but at the point we got to 86, we'd just given up that there was anything out there. And Bednarz and Mueller just serendipitously had a compound they cooled on down, not totally interested in the superconductivity per se, and lo and behold, they found that they had actually doubled the temperature at which we had thought we were bottomed out. So they went up by a factor of two. And then comes an interesting story. I was just comparing notes again with Jim Ho on this, and he's verified the rumors that I've always heard. I call this the Green Superconductor Saga. Mr. Paul Chu recognized, he was a more senior physicist, that if this material that Bednarz and Mueller had discovered could be modified ever so slightly with some substitutions of different alkaline earths, that TC might come up even higher. And he was afraid to publish everybody in this business was a little afraid to tell it out loud because they felt that if you did have other people breathing down your neck, you may not get credit. So even Bednarz and Mueller chose to publish in a journal that nobody ever read, just to put their stamp on it. And they had a very modest title, like Possible Superconductivity. But then Paul Chu decided, well, he'll publish in a well-read journal, we call it Physical Review Letters, but he'll tell a little bit of a white lie, so that in case the referees are leaky, the complete information won't be out there until the last minute. So it was not a total lie, but he gave the wrong formula for what his new material was in the journal. And it was known, the community was chasing after something that had that. I mean, I heard gossip too, but we really got to get, I think it was a terbium in there, which was the wrong formula at the time. And we also knew, the community knew, something exciting happened with the terbium. Paul Chu had a paper. We didn't have yet any access to it, and it seemed to be green, probably just because of some other phases in the material. But it was circulating because he wanted other people to double check so that he could make full claim to the credit. And just the night before it was to go to press in Phys Rev Letters, he called up and said, "Wait a minute, I misspelled it. It's not a terbium, it's yttrium." I think that's perfectly ethical. We were discussing that, but I think, for example, the system has to be leaky when it comes to stuff that important. So I don't hold it against it. The community, of course, was very excited. But, you know, physicists are human beings, and we got all excited. And this was a year later, March. It's our annual American Physical Society meeting. Everybody gathered for an all-night session. We called it the Woodstock meeting. Not rock music, but everybody stand up and talk about what they thought was going on ITC, make their bets. Lots of bets were wrong. And so this is just to give you a sense of how euphoric the community was. I think that euphoria sort of died down and was replaced by almost paranoia. You know, everybody was sharing it all and very open at first, and then suddenly people weren't talking because they wanted to hold it for themselves. Okay, so here's how superconducting, how am I doing on time?
You're fine, it's on hold.
I know, but I don't want them allotted, so.
Up until 5.
Oh, okay. That won't be that long. And feel free to ask if you want to talk. I just lost my little bump here. Here's a figure that shows the transition temperature as a function of time. And I'll tell you what that scale is in a minute, but it starts with camelinonis mercury, liquid mercury, creeps up a tiny bit with lead, niobium, and then it stays kind of static in this regime, but it's more or less at least doubled from liquid mercury. And this is where most of the applications of MRI and superconducting magnets and accelerators came in. They were used, these A15 materials. And then comes 1986, and it takes a big jump. Well, that's not so respectable. It's a factor of 2, almost 20 to 40. But then the really big jump from to the Paul Chu compound, yttrium barium copper oxide. Then it moves a little more with the Japanese group, and then with a group from Arkansas, and then a mercury group actually brings it up to a royally high temperature of halfway to room temperature, which we are excited about, but not enough to make a device. And the part of the reason we're excited is that we crossed the red line. Actually, Paul Chu crossed the red line. Here, it becomes possible to cool this material using a cheap coolant, liquid air, liquid nitrogen, past the boiling point of the nitrogen. And so you can even do a lab experiment in a high school kit and watch superconductors turn from being normal to superconducting. And just to be clear about temperature scales, we have physicists live in the Kelvin world, Europeans in the centigrade world, and I guess Americans in the Fahrenheit world. And so our best superconductor now is pretty darn cold, minus 189 degrees Fahrenheit. But it's halfway. Room temperature is halfway between water and ice, so say 300 Kelvin, and this is 150, so we're halfway there. And of course, obviously, the goal something at room temperature. But conventional superconductors, the ones that find application in MRI and accelerators, are way down, minus 400. So we live in a cold piece of the universe. Okay, so what is superconductivity? We saw the Camerlin-Onnes group's lab notebook, and they showed that the resistance of a metal went away abruptly at some temperature, TC. So what happens is superconductors can conduct current without any loss of energy. That sounds like a really good winning proposition for energy delivery in the near future, because there's no loss. The only price you have to pay is you have to keep it cold. You do have to cool to keep below the superconducting transition. And at this point, these superconductors, the special feature of a superconductor is that it doesn't dissipate when you run current. And you can say, what does that mean? Well, you can see how a toaster works. If you heat up coils, they get hot, and that's the dissipation process, Joule heating. These guys, for a magical reason having to do with this quantum state, just have no dissipation at all. And all you have to do is cool them. But that's not the only thing about a superconductor. The other thing that goes hand in hand is that magnetic fields won't go inside a superconductor because it's so straightforward to set up these currents. The system sets up currents to keep and screen the fields out, so we don't get any magnetic field in the superconductor, and that's known as the Meissner effect. And unless we see this phenomenon as well as this resistance plummeting, you can't really prove you have a superconductor. You have to prove both components, the magnetic component and the resistance. But here's a neat concept that you can set up a ring of current and turn it on, and in a million years, as long as it's kept cold, it won't go anywhere. It will keep going and going and going. So, people have always had a sense that there's some magnificent applications, ultimately, in superconductivity. And here's the story of the Nobel Prize. So one of the first ways to demonstrate this Meissner effect is a levitation, to take a magnet, mixing up where the button is, to take a magnet on top of a superconducting pellet. It's usually kind of blackish. It doesn't look like a metal, high TC cuprates. They're black. They don't have shininess to them. Even more single crystals still don't look that shiny. But you put this magnet on top of the superconductor and you pour liquid nitrogen on. Suddenly, probably a lot of you have seen it, just rises up out from the surface because the superconductors create a magnetic field or expel the magnetic field and push against the magnet. And it's so impressive that you can actually take this guy who weighed, he's a famous sumo wrestler. I didn't know his name, but you can look him up on the web. He weighs 300 kilograms and levitate him, and they show in this little Ig Nobel Prize paper that he's truly been levitated. So it must be very cold for his feet here. He's standing on some vats of liquid nitrogen, but he's been lifted off the ground. And that's actually become a kind of forward-thinking way of designing transport trains and such. I mentioned superfluids in the same breath as superconductors, and I wasn't daring enough to show a movie. I was afraid to get it screwed up. But you can get on the web and see all these phenomenal things that a superfluid can do. It's just like a superconductor, except it doesn't carry charge. It just flows. And it flows without dissipation, which means it flows without viscosity. Something that's viscous is molasses. It's hugely difficult to move it along, but a superfluid will flow without viscosity. So it can climb up the sides of a beaker and just spill over because the capillary force will bring it up and then it just empties its own beakers. It has this magical property, which is very much connected to no resistance, but it's a kind of version of the same phenomenon. And here's this rotating, one of the things that's interesting that relates to the Abrakosov Prize is if you rotate it, container, it's like putting a magnetic field in the charge system, the inside won't spin. It just will stay absolutely still because it doesn't feel the size of the container. There's no
discuss it. And if you spin it fast enough, that's what Alex Abrakosoff discovered, you get these little vortices in where it starts to try to spin and get some response to the rotation. And that was his wonderful idea in the charged superconductor, the idea that Lev Landau told him not to publish. Okay, so maybe you know some of these applications of superconductivity, but I thought I'd tell the forward thinking and the less forward thinking ideas. So MRI, is everybody aware that depends on superconducting magnets? You know for sure you don't bring any metal in when you get an MRI, you bring a necklace or earrings or anything because they'll fly right off. And the magnets that you've created are huge fields, very large fields. You don't just require a big, huge field, but you also need, the whole idea of MRI is you also need a small field gradient. And it's a clever idea by someone, I'll show you a picture of in a minute, that the field gradient allows you to work backwards and image anatomical features. So MRIs are built around superconductors. Accelerator magnets, Nick is just visiting in CERN, they're all built around these guys. They're not 100% foolproof, and so there's some problems going on in the LHC with their superconducting magnets. The Fermi lab has them as well. There's some interesting ideas that came from Brian Josephson's quantum interference idea. And that is a way of measuring, I'll show you, magnetic fields to great sensitivity, even so much so that you can use them in medicine and in Earth's fields, seismography, and so on. The Japanese, I show you, are very forward-thinking and have taken the idea of levitation to a whole new plane, designing trains that are called maglev trains. And the U.S., we're trying to get, there are various companies work with DOE, trying to get some progress in using superconductors, because after all, it costs nothing, as long as you keep it cold, to bring currents around and transmit power. So those are some of the applications, and obviously there are more and will be. So here's what the Japanese did. This actually is their visionary piece, but they have already accomplished a maglev train of a first generation. They're on a second-generation plan now for a train that will be done in 2025 to go 500 kilometers per hour and 125-mile track. Why do that? Well, the idea is if this train is actually levitated like the sumo wrestler off the track, you don't have any track resistance. You do have to pay, of course, to keep it cold. But you don't have any track resistance. And you do have wind resistance. So it maybe the U.S. isn't as excited as, of course, we don't have the same train system that Japan does anyway. But the Japanese have pushed very hard for this visionary train. And they have one already. Question?
Oh, I was just thinking it would be great on the East Coast.
Yeah, I mean, we don't take trains seriously the way Europe and Japan does. But I would hope that the U.S. will get more interested as energy becomes more problematic to some of these ideas that Japan has pretty much embraced. Here, evidently, there is a 33-kilometer track of magnetic levitation train in a test site in Japan. And the story is that they brought, as soon as they opened, a very distinguished crowd of Japanese businessmen on the train, gave them a nice little ride, tried it out. And then the men got off and went off to take care of dinner and other things and realized none of them had credit cards working anymore. All fully erased. So you have to find a new way to do, if you're going to ride a train, find some place to put your credit
cash.
Card. Or cash will come back, right? I don't think they thought that was too funny. So Japan is ahead of us there. Power transmission, the numbers that I hear are that we waste about 20% transporting it around. And so a company in the U.S. called American Superconductor, this didn't come out too well, had a white paper. They're trying to get funding to launch a whole project, which is called the Long Distance DC Superconducting Pipeline. So using both wind in this kind of in the red areas and the superconducting pipeline designs, it will conduct DC. That doesn't come out of your wall because you want AC. So at each of these little loops in this design is the idea that you'd have a DC-AC converter. But there's much more talk as energy gets more expensive that eventually superconductivity might be used for energy transmission. And that company has really taken off. It started a very small company. It's a big success. Okay, so here's the MRI story, and here how cold these magnets are. They're niobium titanium at minus 450 Kelvin, at 450 Fahrenheit. until late 2006, nobody thought of trying to make alternative magnets seriously. But with the high TC and some magnesium diborides that we now have, it's likely, I don't believe they're up and running yet, but it's likely that we may give up the niobium titanium and have MRI in other guises. It's a huge business, MRI. Brings in, when you think about superconductivity attracting money, it's in like $1 billion annual market, and it gives you these remarkably precise anatomical images. This is a picture, another guy from Illinois, although he did it in East Coast, but it's Paul Lauterbur who got the Nobel for conceiving of this imaging technique. Not so much using superconductivity, but the conception of a variable field, field gradient and a static field. Here's some other ideas that have taken off with superconductivity. Based on Josephson's quantum interferometry, this is John Clark at Berkeley, and he made a big business both in his scientific career and also in his some industrial involvement in designing these ideas, these Josephson interference devices to measure magnetic fields to exquisite sensitivity. And it has to do with the fact that what you're seeing here are two superconductors in a two U-shaped superconductors with two junctions between them. And it turns out if you change the magnetic field ever so slightly, this interference pattern that he discovered changes. So it is extremely sensitive to infinitesimal fields. And in the brain, especially to get a patient away from the Earth's field, like in a special new metal material or something, in the brain, the electrical currents that are zipping around, I'm not a biologist, but they're intrinsic electrical currents in the brain, I guess, give rise to magnetic fields, which with squid magnetometry, allow doctors and scientists to localize some of the functional areas of the brain in advance of surgery, and also epileptic seizures. So these squids for brain observation have actually yielded some fruit. And in addition, John Clark is involved in helping with oil detection and all kinds of things that can be enhanced by knowing how to measure small changes in the magnetic field in seismography and geophysics. So one more application. And now come the accelerators. So this is superconductivity for the sake of science itself, not so much applications. This is the picture, the bird's eye view of the Tevatron, which just shut. I don't know, when did it shut down?
October,
sadly. Just out of Chicago. We run it. The University of Chicago runs the Tevatron. It still has life in it, and for different purposes. There are other experiments that will go on. But this was built around superconducting magnets, and it's a proton, anti-proton collider with this niobium titanium 4.2 Kelvin superconductor. And the new life in accelerator physics has switched to Europe with a Large Hadron Collider, which is located between Switzerland, France, I guess it crosses the border near Lake Geneva, and this is the size of it, if you can get some sense, 27-kilometer tunnel. And this is designed to answer some interesting questions that get back to superconductivity itself. So one of the key points, statistics, is, I think this was in the design phase, I don't know if they made it, getting protons to 99.9999999999% the speed of light, with the hope that then you will, by colliding protons and antiprotons, see all kinds of new particles and find out what makes the universe tick. And I want to emphasize in particular finding this Higgs boson. I bet if you read the Tuesday science section of the New York Times, you realize that the LHC is on this, after this holy grail of Higgs boson. So what is the Higgs boson? Well, that came right from superconductivity. Not entirely directly, but I think this gentleman, Chiro Mangu, who's a faculty member emeritus at the University of Chicago, was one key player in understanding this Higgs boson, and he understood, he very early on had seen the BCS paper in 57, and recognized the importance of that paper, and he immediately saw applications to particle physics, and received a Nobel in 2008 for the broken symmetry ideas in particle physics. Anderson, who we saw before as a sort of mentor for Brian Josephson, also had some play in understanding this Higgs boson, but again, out of superconductivity. And the person who would get the Nobel, although it probably could get shared by too many, so it's a problematic Nobel. Is that right? There may be more than, I don't know, there are a bunch of names on the table. It would be, I guess his name is Peter Higgs. And we're awaiting it, and rumors fly, good news, bad news. I think bad news came up too soon. So LHC depends, so LHC is not only chasing a concept of superconductivity, but depends on these huge, massive amounts of superconducting cables and leads, and it's an impressive realization of the impact. Well, how about ITC superconductivity? The problem was that we promised you could go, after you discovered, Ben Hertz and Mueller's discovery, you could go to a hardware store and buy yourself a gizmo in no time. It would be a room temperature superconductor. We never did get there. But today, something like 5,500 cell phone towers use high temperature superconductors, and there's some prototypes in Albany, New York for power transmission. And we will see utility in these high temperature superconductors. Part of the trouble was they're ceramic, and so they're brittle. They don't bend into long wires. You have to immerse them, make them ductile by coating them with copper and other metals. So they and the other problem is they're very anisotropic. They're two-dimensional and plane. So if you don't have things aligned, you might not take full advantage of superconductivity. So we can't quite fulfill the promise, which was probably an inappropriate promise, but time will tell. I think there will be many more applications, given how cheap it is to cool. Okay, so I'm more or less ready to close. This, I just want to remind you, 2011 was the 100th anniversary. So last year we had huge numbers of celebrations of this 100th year discovery of Cameron Onnes's group, Cameron Onnes himself. Just to summarize, of course, the pervasive superconductors, pervasive in science and metal technology because frictionless current can flow. We still have no deep understanding of what high temperature superconductivity, how it behaves and originates. We are still not only fighting amongst ourselves, but the experiments are beautiful, but the theories kind of hit some roadblocks, partly because each theorist doesn't listen to the other theorists, so we don't have any cooperation at all in this field. But the sense is, and maybe that's why everybody doesn't listen to everybody else, because each one feels they're on the road to the next Nobel Prize. And here's what we dream about, materials that would be superconducting in any field. So if you put a big field on, you drive superconductivity away. If you put a big current in, you'll drive it away. So we want to get around the upper critical field and the critical current. And materials that are flexible and not like the ceramics that are difficult to use. So in our dreams, these are materials. Of course, high TC is in itself biggest dream, high meaning room temperature. And just to sort of repeat the motherhood statement that this is a great training ground and even possibly a chance to add to the solution to our scientific enterprise. And here, the even better superconductors, we would hope that someday we'd make it to room temperature. I'll stop there.
Stable, you know,
it's very stable.
Things like that, you know, the
it's very stable once you achieve it, but there's been many instances where we lost a magnet in the accelerator, and you have to take it out. It takes, you warm it up real quick, but it takes a week to cool the whole accelerator down again.
So I can go on flying.
Maybe I can help to spread the word. Not that bad, actually. What they do, the Japanese magnet lab trend, the magnets only on the train, not on the truck. So therefore, it's localized, just a container like the chemistry pump, you know, this this machine for the high frequency ESR. So basically, it's not hard. And the first.
So it's not miles and miles of track.
Yeah, so the train would go down.
So the first version they had is they carry four passengers, moves about 250 miles per hour. The once they start to move, the power that requires 400 watts to maintain this magnet. So because that's a thermal management to just make sure it's no heat getting. Now it's interesting, how about the ground? You need a magnet on the ground. So nothing on the ground. If you have on the ground, it means you cannot go home, right? You pass a track. So what happened on the track with the physics induced EMF. So basically a squall of metal. When the train comes, carry the magnet. Then the loop, in one by one, it become magnet.
Uh-huh.
After train pass, then they go back.
But for your cables, you actually have to have the whole thing cool for power transmission.
Yes, for power transmission. Like the Fermi lab, like the
slightly buried or something.
I mean, this, I don't know why they put so much here, because it seems to me, so much investment in this project, it seems to me wind resistance would already get you. I mean, so the track resistance isn't a major piece of energy saving that you could get rid of it. So. But I think they're far more keen about superconductivity. They fund it quite widely in the country as a whole. They run lots and lots of meetings and conferences, and they have these dreams of really utilizing it. And where the U.S. we're short run, you know. We didn't see immediate payoff. We backed it off. Just too bad.
David, I have a question, which is probably very, very pedestrian. I think I'm incapable of asking anything that's not pedestrian about this. But yeah, there's been so much talk about helium, and I understand the idea to kind of move it up so you don't need the helium types of temperatures. But from a practical perspective, we got a fixed amount of helium.
That's right.
What do we know about the kind of supply and capacity?
I think there is a limited supply, and that they recycle it in our. I assume they recycle in all of these
condensers.
So basically, they try to keep nothing escaping. But yeah, there's a limited supply. We can't abuse that.
A helium shortage is a major problem.
Yeah, even in laboratories, I mean, it's becoming prohibitively expensive for people who just want to do experiments, curiosity-driven experiments, to get running out of resources.
Can I ask you a question? I understand that you have the superconducting generators as well that improves efficiency, such as at Niagara Falls. What's the hope of high-temperature wind power generators that could be superconducting? It's
wind power generators?
Well, wind power generators that become superconducting to make it more efficient.
So we keep it
practical application.
Probably is part of the dreams. I've got the dreams.
I think there's only one company making it.
One company?
Yes.
AMC?
Yeah, it's not probably not the very efficient yet. Superconducting generator for the wind.
And that was very efficient for Niagara Falls because they changed all their generators to superconducting.
Did they? I didn't know. I think it's the wave of the future. I mean, it's certainly going to be in one of the major investments. In addition to great science, it's a lot of fun.
Are there any, I was thinking about military applications, are there any ethical dilemmas? I'm sure there are.
Yeah, I'm sure there are, too.
Applications for weapons of mass destruction. I don't know what happens when you collide things at the speed of light. Are there those kinds of issues, I guess, involved with this? Or what are some of the...
I mean, I would think that would hit the particles community, because you guys have to defend maybe the utility of your curiosity-driven science really
They kicked David Letterman out of DARPA about 10 years ago. He's no longer allowed to attend the DARPA Defense Advanced Research.
So you're saying the basic science is not normally
The representative in DARPA used to be Leon Letterman, and I kicked him out, saying they were no longer interested in particle physicists participating in DARPA. So our hands are now clean.
At the same time, DARPA is paying for this coal gas stuff that I'll talk about tomorrow. DARPA is paying huge amounts of money to support these. These are not, we were talking minus 460 Fahrenheit. These gases are nanokelvin, 10 to the minus 9 Kelvin. They're so cold, and DARPA's decided to take an interest. It's hard to know. I think optics and lasers and things like that, it's all done with lasers that maybe they imagine something good could come of it, something useful to them. You never know when you sign up. Whom you're signing up with.
Other questions? Our scientific talk with Kathy Latta tomorrow at 2 o'clock in Jabara Hall 128. We'll be talking about ultra-cold Fermi gases, prototypes for high-temperature superconductors, and something that's related to my own PhD thesis that worked well in class. So let's thank Kathy.
I think on the high speed planes,